was the eighth interview with Jesse Haber Butler on March 15, 1973. The interview was actually intended to be the final interview with Jesse, clearing up some questions and details that had been overlooked or needed amplification. However, as we got into a discussion of the reasons for her changing her mind about becoming married, a discussion that seemed particularly relevant and important, she asked that I turn off the machine. She then proceeded for almost 1 hour to go into details of the very personal and emotionally upsetting experience that she went through in making the decision. It did not relate to feminism, but related rather to the relationship with her fiancé and his mother in particular. The interview was rather interesting up to this point in placing in perspective her ideas and the fact that though she was a committed suffragist and later identified herself as a feminist, she really did not have broader feminist ideas at that time. It's quite interesting that she relates that she hid her suffrage identification while in Boston, because during this time she did want to get married. Her decision to not get married then related to her active career. Much of the material is quite interesting in contrast to the more radical women involved in suffrage who had a broader conception of feminism. The tape only consists of side A. Side B will be used for a continuation of this detailed mop-up discussion.
What we're going to start with first is talking about a lot of your general attitudes and philosophy in that. I want to know how, at that time, you defined them and your feminist beliefs, what you meant by that. I want to know if you saw the feminist struggle at that time as just the suffrage issue, or if you saw it as a much broader question, and what you thought would happen after suffrage. Then I also want to ask you about your philosophical beliefs at that time. Now, your parents were influenced by Bellamy and probably were socialists, and I want to know about some of your beliefs, if you also had some socialist beliefs. And what was the idea behind the communal living, if that was related to those?
I didn't have that in Boston. It wasn't until I got into Washington.
All of that. That whole period before you left for London is what I'm interested in.
Yeah.
How you thought about things.
In Washington, well, you see, everything completely changed when I left Boston. Mm-hmm. At that time, you see, I was just 25 years old. And frankly, I was worried because I wasn't meeting any men. Now, I don't want to go into this, but I had a rigid rule in college. I would make no dates because I was getting educated. But now I'm 25 years old, and one of the men that represented the public on the Massachusetts Minimum Wage Commission, where I worked, was LaRue Brown. He had been an assistant attorney general in the United States, very brilliant lawyer, and he was unmarried. And after I'd been there and at this point, I'm beginning to think, well, if I'm never going to marry, I hadn't made up my mind to that yet. I did when I got to Washington. And so I began being a little soft on red-hot suffragette. I mean, girls that were trying to get married at that time didn't shout their heads off about woman suffrage. Although I did go and hear Mrs. Pankhurst speak in Boston, I went to the meetings, but I did not work for it at all. Now, I don't think that's wise to go into that. So although I was a suffragette, I wasn't a frothing at the mouth one till I got to Washington and got to know all these girls and got close to the whole movement. And by that time, of course, it was a more popular subject. But at the time I got into Boston, it was a very unpopular subject. And anybody that's interested in getting a man isn't shouting their heads off about suffrage at this moment. Well, then this LaRue Brown one night stopped by my desk and invited me out to dinner. And I had a rule I didn't go to dinner with people that I worked for. And it's a very good rule. You don't want to mix social life up with your work life. But it was so sudden, and also I'd had that bad time when I got up there, you know. They tried to fire me. He was one of the ones that kept him from doing that. So I went to dinner with him. And the next night he stopped by and took me to dinner again and asked me to marry him. Well, I mean, I didn't know the man. He was an exotic type of man. And I hated him because his hands were so dirty. He smoked all the time, and his fingers were covered with, you know, cigarettes, nicotine. And he was untidy and smelly, and like a man that's a bachelor all those years gets careless, you know. And so he took me out to dinner the second night and asked me to marry him, see? So I just simply said, well, I'm sorry. You don't know me very well. I don't think you'd like me very well if you knew me better, and I couldn't marry anybody that I wasn't well acquainted with. But I was just stunned by this. And that summer, I went home to Colorado, and I told my brother about this, and he said, are you a damn fool? Get a chance to, you could have cleaned him up, don't you know that? I said, I couldn't stand him because he was dirty, you know. And he said, what a kind of a fool. How do you think you're ever going to get married? And he just gave me hell, see. So when I went back, he was again hanging around, you know. So I said, before I went, I said, I know that woman you ought to marry. And he said, who is that? And she was a woman down in New York that I'd known very well, a perfectly beautiful woman, and a gorgeous social character, and really just a gem. She had the whole social background. I didn't have any of that, of course. And I said, you really ought to marry her because she'd make a wonderful wife for somebody, and I'm not qualified to be that kind of a wife. So by Jove, he went down there, and then she got engaged to him, and when I got back from Colorado, they were there. They couldn't wait to see me because they thought I'd brought about this marriage, and they took me out to dinner. And Lord, she'd cleaned him up, and you wouldn't have known the man. And I said to myself, well, there you were, just a damn fool. But he was a very, he was from Kentucky, and well, I didn't have anything in common with him, and he wasn't attracted to me sexually either. And they had a very bad marriage. She was very prominent in New England in the League of Women Voters, and they had a baby that was deformed or something, and the baby finally died. And the last time I was in New England, I called on them, and he'd retired, and oh, he was terrible, man, just terrible. So I didn't think I'd done so badly.
So
in all that time, I was not working on women's suffrage. I went to the meetings. I was not identified with them. Of course, I was working for women in the Massachusetts minimum wage. The minute I got out of there at night, I got on a car and went down in the harbor and went swimming. And I told you about,
yes,
that girl. So, and then you see, after you've been in college on a campus, I don't blame these people for going back for degrees because the campus life is so beautiful. And it's really dreary to be in a city like that working. You've no social background. You've no way of meeting people. Finally, I met at the boarding house a Portuguese man.
Yes, you told me about
Yeah,
him.
Terrible.
Well, now, Jesse, there was something called...
So I didn't get interested in all of this till I got to Washington.
So at that time, would you have called yourself a feminist? Do you think
no.
In Boston you wouldn't?
No, I would not have. I was a suffragette, but I didn't shout about that either.
Yes.
I was ashamed of myself that I wasn't getting out and helping. But at that point in my life, I felt I had something else I had to do, was to learn how to get along with men.
Mm-hmm.
And it was obvious this Portuguese man, you see, that taught me to swim and all, well, that would have been a tragedy, and this to marry this LaRue Brown would have been a tragedy.
So when you told me before about that you thought you didn't want to get married, that was later too. Okay, fine.
Because then I'd got a tremendous job and a tremendous salary, and I had prestige. Why get married? That was a different story. And then, of course, I got to knowing all these women that were working for women's suffrage, and I got into the whole system of government, which I'm terribly interested in, always have been, because in a previous life I was in a government position. I'm interested in government, and I've just sent Marjorie. I'm very excited over what I've done. Nobody will know who did it, and that's all right by me. I've given her the whole dope on this child care program and how to put it over, and she's just thrilled. I did it all over the phone. I haven't met her even. I haven't seen her, but she doesn't like to drive, and she couldn't come out here, and I can't drive way up to where she is. And so she called me on the phone. I said, I've got the story for you, but you have to either come here or let me give it on the phone. So I gave her the phone, and she's thrilled because Heidi, the head of the Status of Women Commission, endorses the same program.
Okay. Now, Jessica, when you got to Washington is when you would have started calling yourself a feminist, in other words.
No, I didn't call myself a feminist because in those days that wasn't, you were a suffragette.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't use that term as a title and a label we do now.
Mm-hmm.
We say, is she a feminist now? And that's a concrete thing we're saying. But at that time, we did not talk about feminists in that hard-boiled label. We just said, is she a suffragist? Does she believe in woman suffrage? That was the big issue.
And was that the only issue, did you feel, or did you feel there were broader issues, or it was just the suffrage?
No, I got into the meatpacker deal.
Yeah, but I mean specifically related to women's role.
That's right. I was in the women's role 4 years, copying their payrolls up in Boston in these awful factories. And I got a terrible background of knowledge and information that began to work me up with emotion about the injustice that was going on for women. But before that, I didn't. My father paid my way through college, grumbling all the time, but he did stick it out, see. And although I'd had a very bad family life, for my mother dying at 10, partly due to the bad family situation, and then I had two stepmothers and my first stepmother. But I didn't lay that situation to feminism. I laid it to the pioneer age and the crudity of the pioneer life and the background of these women, and I didn't label it as due to women, to feminism, which it was entirely due to, really. Then I got to London, you see, and I spent 4 years, 3 times a week, with the leading psychotherapist of London,
mm-hmm.
or I'd have been dead. I couldn't have carried on.
So in Washington is when you really would have identified yourself more as a suffragist publicly.
Oh, yes. I went to all the meetings. And, of course, I was earning a living. I hadn't a lot of time, but I went to every meeting of Mrs. Catt and the famous woman that was a minister. Someone was talking about her the other day. I heard all her speeches. Every time they spoke, I was there. But Mrs. Catt didn't know me until I walked into her office and asked to go with her on the Western trip. But she knew the work I was doing in the Congress with the Minimum Wage Commission and with the meatpackers, too.
Now, do you recall, as a young girl, when your mother was working for suffrage, do you recall her talking about it?
No, I felt it.
Mm-hmm.
She didn't talk to me at all till she was dying. And I was with her all that night that she was dying. And then she said, I was a smart girl, was the word she used. Now, that's the first time I knew I was. It was news to me. I was 10 years old. They'd spent all their time trying to squelch me. I was so rambunctious and snorting around and wanting to do things, you see. And then I got into some terrible sex situations that I can't go into. Terrible. You wouldn't believe it.
Now, that was as a child?
Oh, yeah, before I was 10. Oh, awful. The minor life, you see, was terrible. And so I had some terrible experiences. I ran away from home when I was 8 years old. I couldn't take it anymore, and I just went out on the highway and ran away up to the railroad tracks, and I found an old man up there with a whole group of tramps, you know, how the tramps used to always ride on the trains, and I got this old man to help me. Oh, it's a terrible story. And then I had a terrible accident and hurt my head, and then I forgot the whole thing. All these years that I was working, I had no memory. And that's why it took 4 years in London to dig it out. It had to be dug out because it was there, you see. So that's a terrible story, but I had it all written up in minute detail, and I was told to tear it up. I grieve that I tore it up because I had it beautifully written up. But a lot of my family are out there, and it's a bad family story, and somebody might have got hold of it and would have done no good. Those stories, though, of child molestation don't get out. Nobody knows when they happen. And it's a historic story because I got the story, you see, in London. Out, you know. When I was 6 months old, he began tapping my memory. And I was, of what went on when I was from 6 months on. Oh, and imagine that. It's all there right now in your memory, that history of everything that's happened in your life, even your birth. What you went through getting born is there. You never heard such a story.
Well, now, Jesse, do you think that...
I can't go into that.
Just let me ask you, do you think that these experiences, these sex experiences as a young child, do you think this affected your attitude towards men?
Oh, yeah. Oh, right, very much.
And can you elaborate on that?
Well, I can elaborate on it about my brother, you see, when I was... That little girl with a big white hat on, you know, was on the pedestal in the family. And then my brother came. And my mother was German, and the Germans always highlight the men. And so my brother was now a boy. And I had to forget that I'd ever been on a pedestal and wait on him. I remember till he was 5 years old. I had to dress him, put his shoes on. Nobody ever suggested to him he could learn to put his own shoes on. I hated him. He'd just sit there with his feet up in the air, and I had to put his shoes on, you see. And that picture that I gave, I have it right here in the envelope, of when my mother took the picture of us all, and we got down to the photographers, and I had to dress him, put on his shoes, and he was plenty big enough then to put his own shoes on, and I was furious, and I show how furious I am in that picture. I'm still mad. Then my mother cut my hair off. Now, you see, I'm a Libra. I should have never had my hair cut off. Libras are Venus. They're feminine. So that's how she commenced to make me like a boy. Because she didn't want to bother with this hair. You want to see that picture? I've got it right here. I can show it to you in a minute. And I was livid, and I kicked up a frightful row. And my mother was just, when she got home, was just sick. I'd given her such a bad time. I was awful ashamed of myself. But you see, this boy, now he had no aggressiveness. I'm the aggressive one. He was mild and sweet. And everybody said how sweet he was and how lovely. But he became a crook. He got his way through finagling. Those sweet people that haven't the drive and haven't courage and don't fight, then they finagle. Crosser, see? And he made a mess of his life because he was completely spoiled. So I hated him, and I hated men and hated the whole damn outfit. But then after my mother died when I was 10, she told me to get educated, and I was to look after my brother and little sister, younger than he. And I did. I mothered that boy and loved him and was a companion to him after that all those years. I did what she told me to do. And but I wasn't very keen about men, but I knew you had to have a man to be anybody, you see. That's why women hate each other. The fight for men is our great competition, you know. And I finally did have a man invite me to the junior prom in high school, but my high school teacher got him to do it, I think. Now, he sent me some flowers. He was a nice boy. But by that time, I was 17 years old, and I didn't know how to talk. I was awkward and then ill at ease, and that I didn't want to go. That's why I wanted to go to college where there were no men. I didn't know how to get along with them.
But so by the time you went to New York, though, you were feeling that you really should think about getting married, though.
Washington, I did, not New York.
But so before you went to Boston, it was in Boston that started.
Yeah, it was in Boston that started. And then I began to see that I was in an environment where I'd never meet any attractive men, the kind of men I'd like, you see, boarding houses and places like that, you don't. And then, of course, here's this LaRue Brown again, in a high office in the government. If I'd had the imagination that the girl that married him had, why, I'd have picked him up, you see.
Now, did you feel social pressure on you to get married, or where did that pressure come from, do you think, in Boston? Just because you were unhappy and didn't think you...
Well, I was lonely, you see, and I had no home, and I didn't know... I liked this Portuguese, was a handsome fellow, you know, sexually. He was the one that aroused me sexually. I was 24 years old then. Mm-hmm. And... He was very keen on me, really, and took me swimming every night and taught me how to swim. And but weekends, he would go back down to southern Massachusetts, where his family lived, and he was never there for weekends because he said his father was a drunkard, and he came home and beat up his mother, and he had to be there to protect her. This was the story he told. And so he was never there weekends, see? And he hadn't asked me to marry him, but I think he was wanted to. I think he was very interested in me. And then I had a dream. I told you about mm-hmm. that. And that he had a girl down there that his mother had picked for him to marry. And he was a good home boy to do what his family said. And so he was terribly upset trying to decide what to do. And so when he came back, I told him about the dream, and he never showed up again. I never heard a word from him. That was the end of that. Now, and soon after that, I went to Washington.
Now, at Smith College, did you think that you should get married? Did you feel
no?
It wasn't.
No, I didn't want to get married. But Ethel Lewis, who was a very wealthy girl, lived on Long Island, had me there for Christmases, and her father adored me. Every time I went and visited these girls, the father said, "That's one of the finest girls all." And he was crazy about me, her father was. He thought I was the most interesting girl that he'd ever seen. And when I visited her Christmas, he got us boxed to the opera and to the theaters. He was the head of a big newspaper, the New York Evening Telegram, and he was the editor. Brilliant man. And he was crazy about me, and he had me there. They had me there for two Christmases in this beautiful home. And there I met Horace Lyon, who was a buddy of her boyfriend. And so he was a handsome fellow, this Horace Lyon, and much more wealthy even than her boyfriend, very wealthy. He's the Lyon's tooth powder, you know. And he had they had a home in New Jersey, and they had a big apartment in New York and one in New England. And I knew I'd never get any better chance than that, and he had me come and visit his family for dinner. And he was with me at the opera, some of the big operas where the great famous singer sang. And wasn't that an experience, though? But you know, I was so undeveloped emotionally. I was still just like a little girl, 16 years old. I didn't know how to handle the situation. I was terribly immature. A lot of girls that menstruate late are late maturing, and they're the ones that don't get old young. That's why I'm alive now, see? So he came clear to Colorado to get me to marry him after I graduated. Mm-hmm. And he just had one fault, who was bad enough. He was a perfect darling, very good looking, very faithful type, but he had no humor. I never met anybody in my life that was devoid of humor. You know, they're terrible. Within half an hour, I couldn't think of anything more to talk about. I never had anybody bore me as he did. I was just bored to my heels. well, you can't marry somebody like that, at least I couldn't. I knew I'd never get a chance like that. He came out to Colorado and my family had a fit at the way I treated him.
So then when you got...
So at this time, I couldn't be worrying about feminism, mm-hmm. suffrage, and all that, you see.
Now, at Smith College, was there a suffrage club on
oh, no.
campus there?
Oh,
there
no.
was nothing?
Oh, it wasn't done. Smith is very reactionary on the feminist movement. Always have been. They're bad now, and they don't even have good speech classes yet.
Mm-hmm.
I get letters. I just had a letter the other day, all the time, begging for money. And I just like to write and tell them what I think of them. They're really a reactionary thinking outfit. Although some fair, well, Gloria Steinem's a graduate, so is Betty Friedan.
Well, Jesse, then when you got down to Washington and became involved in this exciting career, is when you decided then that you didn't want to marry.
Yeah.
I
was in no hurry anyway. Mm-hmm. Then I met Hugh and he didn't want to marry, so I had a boyfriend. We went out to dinner every night, Dutch treat, you know. He came to my office and we had marvelous companionship, and that I wanted.
Mm-hmm.
And I never have seen any other man in my life that could give that kind of companionship. You could. I never
now,
saw.
Was it very common in those days when a couple went out to dinner for them to Dutch treat her?
Oh, yes. If
was.
You were working and he's working, oh, sure. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I wouldn't have thought of the... I think I was getting a bigger salary than he was, or as big. And, it was just automatic that I was paid for my own dinner and he paid for his.
And was it important to you that you pay your own way?
Oh, we just never thought about it. I mean, I pay, and he's there, I pay. It was no issue.
There was no issue.
Oh, no, it was just natural,
mm-hmm.
utterly natural. But I never saw anybody. I've never seen anybody since. I've never seen any man that I could be the companion to I was. And my teacher told me the other day over there, I was telling her how I got that, I told you how I got that man interested in the minimum wage bill in mm-hmm. one of, didn't I, Ben Johnson. She said, well, she was a little annoyed with me the other day because I was picking on her and she didn't like it. I've got to straighten myself out. She made a brilliant sermon about the world of tomorrow. And it's on self-genesis that's developing, and the theme of it is how everybody in the world today is now developing and getting a chance to develop as a human individual. Of their own status, completely individual within their own aptitudes. And she calls that self-genesis that's developing instead of tribal. We had tribal genesis, and then we had family genesis where the family ruled, and now we've got self-genesis where the family doesn't rule, you rule yourself. That was a brilliant sermon. But all she used, the word man, is getting into self-genesis. She didn't even once say mankind. So after the sermon, I had some notes to ask her about some of the things in my life that are troubling me, and she always has the right answer. She's an amazing counselor. And you see, now I went to this man 4 years. I know counseling. She's got him licked. She's absolutely amazing. And then I touched on this. I said, there's just one more thing I wanted to bring up, I said, that made me unhappy today, is this man, use of man, and most of your congregation were women. You didn't have six men there. And so I felt very bad when you were talking about the self-genesis man, and you gave no mention of women. And, she hit the ceiling. She really hit it. She was furious. And she said that man stands for women. Yes, I said, that's what you all think. But when we sit and listen, we don't think we're included. And I said, I suffered through your sermon there, really. Although it was a great sermon, it was delivered to men, and I am not a man. And she said, no, and she says, you don't like men. I said, now, don't be funny, my dear. You have no woman in that church that's been married 52 years and half of their husbands don't even come. My husband went with me for 18 years to that church. You think I'm against men? I know how to get on with men. And how did I get this difficult man in Congress to help me get my bill through that nobody could deal with? If I didn't like men, how would I have gotten his cooperation? Well, she says, you're what's called an androgenic. It means you're part man, part woman, which Jesus was. Mm-hmm. What's the word?
Androgynous,
that's right. Jesus was androgynous. He was feminine, soft, and gracious, but he took a whip to get those men out of the, didn't he? When he wanted to whip them out of the temple, he had a whip. That's androgynous. And she said, well, of course, you're an androgynous woman. And that, because I have been a man in previous lives, and I've been in high government positions. That's why I love it and understand it, see? But she said, there is no other word to use than except mankind. And I said, you didn't even say mankind once.
Well, you can use humankind, too.
Well, that's... Human? See? She hit the ceiling. Society? In the thesaurus under man are all these other words, see? Well, Dr. Preska here at this college gave a talk the other day to an audience of 600 people, and she's a modern, she's a feminist, but she doesn't advertise it. She's now head of the whole faculty in there. Well, I must tell you this, and then we must go on. But the present person there, and so I told his mother. And they wanted me to come to the banquet and pay $15. And I said, I haven't got the $15. And I went last year. And he's a marvelous speaker. He is great. And got a sparkle to his speaking. So I told his mother, I said, I wanted to call Dr. Preska and complain about her subject. How do you know an educated man? Why not an educated person? So at the banquet, he's sitting at the head table with Mama on the right and Preska on the left. And so Mama says to Preska, Mrs. Butler's room's next to me, Mrs. Preska, and she's been telling me about you. Oh, says Mrs. Preska. But she says to her, she doesn't like the sermon of your talk today. This is before she's given the talk. And Mrs. Preska said, what was wrong with it? And she said, why? She said, you said an educated man. Why not educated persons? She changed her title as she started to talk. So I told her, see, now there's one way to just quietly. I wasn't in it at all. I had a right to tell her I didn't like to talk. So she changed the title. She said there's been some objection to my title. And of course I do mean persons, not just men. Before she spoke.
Jesse, do you think, how far back do you
Now I'm going to tell you one more thing. At the board meeting of our women's club, at our now, I told this story, not to brag, but to show that we can be a feminist all over the place and do feminist things without being disagreeable. So I told the story, and Joan Richardson, who never loses a chance to say something dirty to me, spoke up at once and said, well, you got somebody else to do your dirty work for you, didn't you? And I said, I didn't do it to do a dirty work. I did it as a feminist.
How far back do you think those ideas go? When did you start expressing those
Well,
ideas?
I remember vaguely the day I saw my mother climb into that spring wagon to go out and do precinct work on woman suffrage. And I was curious. Why didn't she take me with her? So she never, all she did to get me to help her in that housework is to wash dyedies. Why, you see, I don't know until she died. Then she said I was a smart girl. I was taking things in. Then, of course, the question of where do babies come from arose when my brother and I were 6 and 7 years old. And we discovered where the cats came from and where the cows came from. So when my little sister came and I was 7, I asked my mother, we began asking her sharp questions, didn't we? Because we sensed we weren't getting the truth. And you see, that's German for you, you know. The Germans have they're very stuffy about talking about things like that. Anyway, everybody was in those days. So when my sister came, I said, where did she come from? And she said, the storks brought her. And I couldn't wait to get to my brother, and we rolled on the floor with glee and said, what kind of fools did she think we were? I was seven. So I commenced to notice things, and then I remember in the eighth grade in high school, in the eighth grade in the grammar school, I had a teacher named Miss Chase. She was a very good administrator, but dominating type of woman. And I remember looking at me one day and saying, Jesse Haver, what am I going to do to stop you talking? You never stop. And right, of course, right in front of the whole school. Now, of course, if she'd known how to teach public speaking and given me some nice assignments and a chance to say what I thought, I wouldn't have talked all the time all over the place. 3 weeks ago, she came to me in my sleep. Now, evidently, wherever she is, she came walking along. She sees that all that talk wasn't exactly a waste of time or just nothing but gabble, see. So, you see, I was trying to develop against awful odds, but my mother, and then you saw the doll that my mother gave me. Now, she should have known better than that. I never played with dolls. I never played with that doll. She gave me that because she said it was the last year she was going to live. She was psychic. She had a lot of ESP in her, all right. There's no doubt of it. Mm-hmm. And then I got into high school, and then I had a wonderful teacher that I loved and told all my sorrows to. And then, of course, as a miracle, a red-haired girl got into that high school class, an English girl.
Mm-hmm. You told me about
her. And they had that ranch, and he was from a titled family in England, and there I spent many weekends, because they knew what I was going through with my stepmother, who was really senile, a mental case. So they had me up there, and they talked to me as if I was not just a girl. The British don't bring up their girls like that, you know. If they see a girl's got a mind, they let her develop it. They don't tell her she's got to be a sweet little girl and not know anything.
All your life as a child, you felt pressure from people that you should behave more like a girl.
It wasn't that heavy, mm-hmm. that I behaved like a girl. Just I'd be endurable. They tried to quiet down my aggressiveness, but they didn't say. I think it was after I was through college that my father said something about, you have to learn how to handle men better or you'll never get married. I think that's the first time I ever heard that. Mm-hmm. No, I don't think they rammed otherwise she'd have let me get in that kitchen and help cook. And finally, I did get into a domestic science class in high school, and I adored it. I remember I made scrambled scalloped cabbage once and a lot of dainty things that my mother didn't know how to make, and I was just stunned. I loved it. I thought it was so exciting. Evidently, my mother's cooking was pretty crude, you know. But they didn't try to make me learn how to cook. So the only thing she learned that I did very well, she gave me money and sent me clear into Pueblo, a mile and a half from that ranch. I had to walk a mile to the streetcar, and I did all her buying for her. And she found I was clever at that, and so she had me do that because she couldn't get in there often, you see. No, I don't think there was a... I don't feel that at this big meeting I went to the other day on churches for the now, they told some awful stories the way they were brought up. And I don't think that the pressure was on me to be a girl, especially. It was to be endurable so they could live with me, you know.
Well, so it was basically then that all of this, a lot of these feelings came out and these thoughts came out in Washington.
And yeah, when I got mature, mature.
Do you think it was related to your satisfaction with the job?
Yeah, I was important. I had a big job, and I saw that being like a man had its value instead of being like a woman. And then this red-haired girl that I saw, I went to visit her repeatedly with her three children, and she was in hell, I thought. I thought she was in a horrible position. He had a high position in Yale University, and there she was glued to this home and the children and cooking and everything. I thought, thank God. I think it was that visit to her when I was in Washington that made me say, boy, I'm not going to get into a boat like that. I think that's when I made up my mind. It was horrible. I saw it, you see, what she was being, what the demands on her were. She's dead now. She went through an awful time.
Well, that must have been very difficult, Jesse, to switch ground and give up your career when you then did decide to marry.
I nearly died. I really nearly died. I had a terrible experience, but I can't go into that. I mean, that's... I just nearly died. I'll tell you what happened. See, after I'd been eating dinners with Hugh for 4 years, we were companions, you know. We told each other everything we were doing and thinking. And then he got me into Christian Science, and so we read all the Christian Science lessons that I just loved. And they're beautiful lessons. Beautiful. And they're not the Orthodox religions, you see. She got them out of that Orthodox. So anyway, then he got this job in London. I sicked him onto it. In fact, I tipped him off to it. And he was absolutely wedded to his family, glued to his mother. And she was a Christian Science practitioner. I told you about her and how she came to Washington and said he was never going to marry and so on. Well, then he got his job over there, and I went on this tour with Mrs. Catt. And while I was gone, he went home, persuaded him for Christmas. I was with her in California that Christmas at the big Hilton Hotel, staying there. We had our Christmas there with a very famous California suffragette. While he was home for Christmas, he got his father to retire from his lifelong business and sell everything and come to Washington and live in our house.
In the communal house?
Yes. And when I came back, there they were, his mother, this dominating woman and husband. And I never asked my advice or anything on this trip. There they were. Did you ever hear such a thing? And so when I got back, I said, why, Hugh, we had a rule that nobody was to get into this house but without the permission of both of us. And you ruined my home. It's gone. And he said, well, he said, we were so happy there, he wanted them to come and learn to be happy with us. What he wanted to do was find a way to get rid of them, but he didn't know that, see. He was so glued to him, he couldn't shake them. And she took over that house at once.
How did the other people in the house react?
Hated it. Told us where we all had shelves, where we kept our food, and... She just took over, period. And I remember we had a clock right by the front door so that as we went out, you know, we could look and see what time it was. She didn't like the clock in that place, so she moved our clock. Well, I mean, it was just a little issue, but still, it was our clock, our house, too, see? And then he stopped eating dinner with me. He had to eat with his family, he said. And then I said, you damn fool, you've gone and got used to him, and you're the damn fool. Now you're missing him. I'd eat dinner all alone. I had nobody to talk to. And he wouldn't, I'd once in a while, he'd ask me to go for a little walk out in the park, but that she was watching him the whole time. And he was up reading Christian Science with her, and they didn't invite me there to join them either, only once in a while, see? And I said, you damn fool, now you've gone and got yourself all mixed up with a man after all, which you said you were never going to do. So when spring came, this was in the winter, oh, it was hideous. The love and joy and everything just walked out of that house. It was just terrible. She was a terrible, domineering woman, and her husband was going through hell over it. A man that had a terrible suffering. But it stuck it out all these years. Wouldn't have anything to do with Christian Science because they did the Christian Science by themselves with just the children. So when spring came,